Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. Good day, citizens, and thank you for listening. This week, one of my favorite subjects, archaeology, history. We talk about Tunney and the map discovered in France.
When you think about the Indian peoples that Lewis and Clark met, you think of the Shoshone and the Mandan and the Lakota and the Clatsop. You don't normally put the Arikara high on your list. They deserve a much higher place on anyone's list than they have had. And this fellow from the University of New Mexico, a man named Dr. Christopher Steinke, discovered in the Institut National de France a map that this man, Tunney, the Arikara, who traveled with Lewis and Clark for a time, drew for them. It actually has an image of the keelboat on it. It has stick figures of Lewis and of Clark. He drew a map for them, took that map to Washington, D.C. He died in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, it was buried there. That map has disappeared for more than 200 years, David, and it was recently rediscovered. And I devoted this whole May issue of We Proceeded On, the official journal of the Lewis and Clark World, which people can subscribe to by going to the Great Falls site. I devoted the whole issue to this extraordinary map, and I knew the minute I started working on this that you would find it fascinating.
Oh, and I really did. And really, that's what we talk about this week. And you can find out more about We Proceeded On, the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation, and how to join so you can get copies of We Proceeded On if you go to jeffersonhour.com. And there's also a pretty high-resolution copy of Tunney's map that you can see at that website. And while you're there, I'll keep it just real. I won't even do the voice and just
come on, do the voice.
No, I don't want to. Well,
hello.
You can support the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We really appreciate it. All support goes directly to the show, and without it, we are nothing.
So, David, what people maybe don't know this, but I knew you in the Lewis and Clark context way before I knew you
right
in the Jefferson context. And yeah, I was doing a big 13-hour, 13-part radio documentary,
right,
for public
radio.
I still
have a copy of that somewhere.
And I came here to do some of the work, and I contacted you. I had heard of you, and I knew of your great work with Native American music and culture. And I said, would you be willing to provide some studio time and so on? And I interviewed Dayton Duncan in this very space.
Right.
And that was a great day.
What a great guy.
But then you then provided music for Ken Burns' film.
Some of it, yes, not all of it.
And you showed me one of the greatest moments of my entire life was when you showed me that there is a living, faithful Hidatsa oral tradition of song that can be dated back to Sacagawea.
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting discovery for me, too.
That you were working with a young Native American woman who was
Nellie
singing,
Hall,
she was
right,
singing like pop songs and crossover songs, and you said, do you have any like traditional songs? And she sang one, and because of your work with a woman named Frances Densmore, who was an ethnomusicologist who came out to the Great Plains.
Oh, boy, careful, or we're really going to have a long
but
intro.
Just but I can give you the short answer to it. But you recognized that this young woman's 20th century, early 21st century song was a not very different rendition of a song dated back to Frances Densmore in the beginning of the 20th century.
Pretty spot on.
She was recording on cylinder discs, and you've just gotten praise for having remastered some of those cylinder discs and gotten them to the right speed. They were being played at the wrong speed for decades.
That's a long story, too.
But all I'm saying is that I knew you in Lewis and Clark world long before I knew you in Jefferson, before you became the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And you've won awards for that work.
Oh, stop.
And now this map, here's my goal. I want to get Russ Eagle out here. You know Russ.
Oh, great, yeah.
And we're going to rent a pontoon and start at Mobridge, South Dakota, and go up the river along the Tunney route.
Nice.
To see Jupiter's house and to see the Medicine Rock and to see the ancient ruins of the Mandan villages and all the things that Tunney tells to Clark. You've never seen them from the river. I've never seen them from the river. The river is now a lake. That's part of it. But I want to take that journey with maps, journals, Tunney's map, and follow that for 2 or 3 days and photograph the living daylights out of it.
Boy, that would be fun.
Wouldn't that be something to really and you
would,
could bring the drone?
Yeah, and you know, if there's anybody who's really interested in this Densmore audio connection, maybe we
would help us do our documentary.
No, I mean, that would be a fun thing to talk on the Jefferson Hour, unless it's a little too far out of range. But
it's not out of range because, as you know, we talked in this show about Jefferson's instructions, and if he could have said, "Oh, and take a cylinder disc and record Native American sounds," of course he would have done that. The technology didn't exist.
So let's go to the show. So this week we're talking about Tunney and the maps and a number of things.
Subscribe to We Proceeded On.
Go to jeffersonhour.com if you can't find it, and we'll have links there. And once again, thank you for listening. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Your weekly conversation, well, this week it's with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the man who portrays Jefferson when he's here, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, David.
And as I would always start with a pleasantry with Mr. Jefferson, I shall start the same with you, sir. How's your garden doing?
Well, it is planted, that's for sure. And it was the latest planting that I can remember. I finally got it finished around the 5th of June, 2018. In North Dakota, where we live, you really don't dare plant your tomatoes before Memorial Day.
Yeah, no profit in it.
Because they often freeze.
Or stunt.
And so I waited, and we've had really an unusual spring, and I've been traveling and busy, and so I finally got out there, and now I have two gardens, my large vegetable garden, which has 50 tomato plants and 6 rows of sweet corn.
Oh, you show off.
And onions and beans and peas and cucumbers and
so
on.
We need to get
on.
Up and get some photos like we have in previous years.
That would be
years.
Good. Bring the drone.
Yeah, I happily do
and
that.
And then the other garden, the Jefferson garden, is the raised garden. And in it, with the help of our friend Pat Brodowski of Monticello, the head gardener there, I have planted mostly Jefferson seeds. And then I planted what are called Three Sisters. You know what that is. Three Sisters are Native American combinations in one hill of beans, sometimes squash, sometimes corn, but three plants, and the corn stalk then becomes the prop, and the beans then grow around it, and so on and so forth. And this was the sacred way, or at least the very deeply established way of planting amongst the Mandan and the Hidatsa. So I always do that. So it's all planted now, and then it's been dry, as you know, and so I got out 4 sprinklers, and this year I've tried to place them where they will get to every corner of the garden. You know, there's always one beleaguered corner that doesn't quite get enough. But it'll cost a fortune, I think, this summer. I don't think we're gonna have enough.
All that matters is that you can go out there in the shank of the evening and sit and look and enjoy, as Jefferson, I'm sure, did.
Well, I do it for 2 reasons. I do it because of Thomas Jefferson, and I do it because of my grandmother, Rhoda Strauss, of Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
And you do it because you like to eat.
And then I can the living daylights. I still have about 150 jars of tomato sauce from last year. So,
oh, my.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I called this program this week. I asked if we could revisit something that we touched on in an earlier show. And that is the Tunney map. And you, since we discussed this the first time, have given me a copy of We Proceeded On, which is the publication of the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation.
And people can subscribe by going to the Heritage Foundation's website in Great Falls, Montana. And for a small fee, you get all 4. You become a member, but you get all 4 issues of this journal, We Proceeded On.
And, of course, we will put a link, if there's not already one there, on our website. I believe the map has been posted there because we've had a number of interesting inquiries about the map. In fact, I think you just got a letter last week from someone who was very excited about it. We talked about that.
Well, it is exciting. So I recently—
Oh, it's astounding.
I've been doing a little media based upon it because it's a discovery. So let me quickly set the stage.
Right.
Lewis and Clark traveled through the Missouri country and the Columbia River country between 1804 and 1806. And they brought back this extraordinary map that was published in 1814, Clark's map. It's really one of the masterpieces of American cartography. But we like to think of them as having traveled into this completely unknown country without any ideas because they were explorers. That isn't true at all, David. They were really working from previous knowledge of other white traders and explorers, at least up to today's North Dakota. And then west of today's North Dakota, Native Americans were drawing maps for them on the ground, putting little piles to show mountains and using sticks to show rivers and tributaries and so on. And so when Lewis and Clark left Fort Mandan, Lewis says, "We were now about to penetrate a country at least 2,000 miles in width upon which the foot of civilized man has never walked." But the fact is they already had a pretty good sense from the native peoples who were their hosts of what they should expect to find. And so most of those maps that were written in snow or written on skins of animals or written in the dirt naturally have disappeared forever. A few of the maps have survived, and one of them, maybe the best of all the maps, has been languishing in a French archive for more than 200 years in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris, and it was discovered by a researcher at the University of New Mexico by the name of Dr. Chris Steinke, and he wrote an article about it in William and Mary Quarterly in 2014. A friend of mine in Montana brought it to my attention.
And you interviewed Mr. Steinke for this issue of WPO.
That's correct. I thought of reproducing his essay, but I thought, well, it's already been published. I can turn people to it. But then I interviewed him, and I got the two great cartographers in the Lewis and Clark world, a man named Herman Viola of the Library of Congress and John Logan Allen, formerly of Yale, but most recently the University of Wyoming at Laramie. I got them to assess the map. They wouldn't assess it. Neither of them knew about it. They wouldn't assess it unless I sent them extremely high-quality laminated versions of the map. And so I had to get it in high resolution and take it to a laminator. I sent them to them, and then they wrote back and basically just said, "Wow."
Well, see, and that's one of, you know, if I can let my own excitement come out about this, one of the things that really floored me about this is that here it is a couple hundred years later, more than, and we're still finding very important artifacts connected to Lewis and Clark, and it makes me wonder, you know, what else is out there?
You are correct, sir. So a man named Harry Fritz, who's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Montana at Missoula, an old friend of mine, friend of a teacher of Stephanie Ambrose Tubbs, the daughter of the great late Stephen Ambrose, he said during the bicentennial, "Well, we basically know everything we're ever going to know about this story.
Right.
You know, how many times are we going to kick around the same can?" Well, he was wrong. And so this map is one of the discoveries. Also, James Holmberg of the Filson Club down in Louisville was part of the discovery of 50-some letters by William Clark that were in an attic in Louisville, and they were discovered, and he published them in 1989. There are probably, well, we know Robert Fraser kept a journal. Well, it could still be out there. Lewis maybe have kept journals that we don't have yet. I mean, things get lost, and so maybe we'll find more.
And there are sites, historical sites. You and I have spent a great deal of time talking about where the actual site of Fort Mandan is in North Dakota, and nobody really knows. And,
I know someone who knows, but we'll find out.
They, you know, the thought is that it was completely destroyed by the river changing course and
maybe,
floods.
Maybe not.
But then, you know, you look at what's going on archaeologically and the use of satellites to find unusual depressions, and they've discovered, you know, Viking villages and things like that. So who knows what's going to come up in the next 5 or 10 years? And that's one of the reasons, after reading this issue of We Proceeded On, I got so excited about it.
Well, it's very important. So let me just say, this map is a very, very significant discovery, and all hail to Dr. Christopher Steinke for doing it and publishing the pioneering article in the October 2014 issue of William and Mary Quarterly.
He's still looking for things in Europe, isn't he?
Yes, and others too. And so there are plenty of people doing this. But as I say, things get mislabeled, or the labels are so vague that you can't really know what you're looking at. What I am amazed at, he was not a Lewis and Clark guy. He's now at the University of Nebraska, Kearney State. He was looking at Native American cartography, so maps by Native peoples, indigenous maps. And he happened upon this, and he was shrewd enough, well enough trained in history, that he realized, oh, this is a Lewis and Clark map, and here's the story. Lewis and Clark got to the Arikara villages in northern South Dakota along the mouth of the Grand River. And they came there about October 8th, 1804. And while they were there, they met a leader of the Arikara whose name is Tuni or Arkidarnarshar or Piaheto, but let's say Tuni for the purposes of today. And he was a highly intelligent man who then accompanied them from the Grand River all the way up to what became Fort Mandan. So he traveled with them for about 3 weeks, and then he stayed on diplomatic mission amongst the Mandan and Hidatsan, was trying to work out a reconciliation between the Arikara and the Mandan. And then Lewis and Clark said, well, would you be willing to go to Washington, D.C. to meet the Great Father? Jefferson had instructed Lewis to try to convince Native leaders to come to Washington to meet him. And so they convinced Tuni to make the long journey from northern South Dakota to Washington, D.C. He went with an interpreter by the name of Joseph Gravelines, who plays an important part in this story. He met Jefferson, and then, unfortunately, Tuni died in Washington, D.C. on April 6th, 1806. So now this emissary from the Arikara has gone off to meet the Great Father and died. So Jefferson writes a famous letter of condolence and sends it back up the river with Joseph Gravelines to the Arikara. And so, but the point of all this is that while Tuni was in the presence of Joseph Gravelines and others in St. Louis and eventually Jefferson, he produced a map, and that map is the one that was discovered, and it's filled with extraordinary, fascinating material about how the Arikara saw North America.
I want to talk to you more about Joseph Gravelines later in the conversation. I don't know a lot about him, and I learned so much reading this issue of We Proceeded On, and his relationship with Toussaint Charbonneau, or I guess the timing about Toussaint Charbonneau sort of became an unhappy employee.
So for those that don't know, Charbonneau is the husband of Sacagawea, and Lewis and Clark hired him, and they were going to go to the Rocky Mountains, but Charbonneau was kind of a rascal, and he went on strike. And Lewis and Clark said, well, the heck with it. We'll take somebody else. And they almost took this Joseph Gravelines as their interpreter. If they had, we wouldn't know who Sacagawea is.
This is the time of year when I'm always interested to revisit Lewis and Clark and all aspects of it. And thanks to this article, we have some new grist for the mill.
The important thing, David, is that this is a significant discovery in Lewis and Clark's studies. It is not true that there's nothing more to say. And it has particular importance for North Dakota because the map, it includes everything from Santa Fe to today's Winnipeg, but the map really centers on the land between the South Dakota border and Old Fort Mandan, and it really opens a whole new world in one of the parts of the Missouri River Basin that are not that well known.
I have many more questions if you will entertain that, sir.
Of course.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to The Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we're speaking with the creator of The Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, and we're talking specifically about Lewis and Clark and Tuni, and this wonderful discovery of a map in France.
I take no credit for the discovery of the map. That was this Dr. Christopher Steinke at the University of New Mexico, and now at the University of Nebraska at Kearney State. But my friend Kevin O'Brien out in Missoula is an archaeologist, and he saw the article in William & Mary Quarterly. And so when I was out on my annual Lewis and Clark cultural tour, where we canoe on the White Cliff section of the Missouri and we hike up on the Wendover Death March and so on, he said to me one night—
It's not really a death march.
No, it's not. I just make that up. But he said to me one night at Eagle Camp, which is in the heart of the White Cliffs, one of the most beautiful places in the world, he said, I want to show you something. And so I thought, oh, what's this going to be? And he rolls out this map, and I was flabbergasted. And I said, right then, I'm the new editor of this journal We Proceeded On that's published by the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation in Great Falls. I want you to write an article of any type you want about the importance
of
this map.
It's an amazing article, quite lengthy.
And it's right up your alley, David, because what he says in it is that indigenous maps are different from Anglo-European maps, and you can't read, I'm using air quotes, an indigenous map unless you adjust the way you see. And if you do adjust the way you see, all sorts of remarkable information comes rolling off that page.
As we said earlier, you interviewed Dr. Christopher Stanky, and I want to read something from that interview. You asked him what the map's significance was, and he answered, "The map is quite significant for understanding indigenous history on the Great Plains at the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition. I think it's especially important not only for considering how Native peoples viewed Lewis and Clark and indigenous diplomacy with the Americans, but also for considering Native diplomacy with other indigenous peoples," which sort of leads me back to this trip that Tooney made to Washington. Can you talk about that?
So he goes at Lewis and Clark's request all the way to St. Louis and then all the way to Washington, D.C. overland, and he meets the Great Father, Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson is impressed. He regards him as a remarkable Native person. General James Wilkinson, who was a very odd human being, but our chief military officer in the West, he said he was a genius and that he knew 11 languages and that he knew a Native American sign language and was sort of a...
Yeah, but that's astounding. Do you think they were stretching that? Or you were
no, I don't think so, because these were basically people who were very contemptuous of Native...
Yeah, why would they? Right, yeah.
And so the fact that they recognized... The question is that I raised at the beginning of this issue of We Proceeded On is, if Jefferson saw the capacity of Tooney and General Wilkinson realized that he was a kind of a Native American genius, why were Lewis and Clark relatively ho-hum about him? And that's the part I don't get.
Well, let me ask you, before you go on with that, were there any Native interpreters that they were not ho-hum about?
Yes, particularly a Mandan leader by the name of Posakopsehe, or the Black Cat. He was what they called the grand leader of the two Mandan villages. And Lewis says of him, "This is a very remarkable human being. This is maybe the most extraordinary Native person that we have met on this journey. He's thoughtful. He's benevolent. He's filled with information. He asks the right questions." He also then, unfortunately, goes on to say, "And he might be very useful to our American purposes in the West." Now, they always had that kind of instrumental view as, what can you do for us? When they thought about Indians.
Nothing has changed about that, has it?
Give really? Us your land, yeah. I think is the correct answer. But so that was one. Then David Nicandri, our mutual friend, talks about Twisted Hair and Ted Oharski of the Nez Perce, of the Nimiipuu, who were important to Lewis and Clark also.
We've established that Lewis and Clark, neither one of them thought Tooney was too important.
They didn't go out of their way, let's put it that way.
My impression was that Jefferson really didn't devote a whole lot of time to him either, did he?
But he thought he was remarkable, but of course Jefferson is Jefferson. He's spinning 50 different plates at the same time. He meets him. There is an account of this meeting. In fact, there's one in this magazine, in this journal, by a man named William Dunlap, which I thought was the most fascinating part of everything except the map, David. This man, Dunlap, was a writer and a playwright and an actor and a painter, and he was in Washington, D.C. during this period, and he happened to meet Tooney, and he wrote this extraordinary account of meeting him in a boarding house. Tooney was sitting on a mattress. Really amazing. And then I got a young woman friend of mine, Katrina Case, of Anamoose, North Dakota, to paint a kind of courtroom sketch of what it must have been like for Senator Samuel Mitchell of New York to sit in that boarding house and meet Tooney and hear an account of his map and hear an account of his travels and so on.
Diplomacy that he had to go through in order for Tooney to even speak to him.
It's just, yeah, because Tooney wasn't just going to talk.
No.
And you know this from your own deep immersion with Native American culture. You don't just wander in as an Anglo and say, "Hey, tell me everything." That there's a whole world of reticence and shyness and decorum that you have to understand, and you can't be in a hurry.
Now, I'm not so sure shyness is the right word, but it describes it well.
Shyness as perceived by Anglos, let's put it that way. And so if you just go in and say, "Hey, I'm here to hear about your sacred oral traditions. Would you mind just telling me everything?" You know, that doesn't work too well, as you know better than anyone. And so Tooney wasn't just immediately available to Senator Mitchell. Mitchell had to sit there and sort of wait till the moment when Tooney felt like talking. But when he opened his mouth, it's a rich, wonderful account of his own world.
But I still go back to Lewis and Clark didn't think he was that special. Jefferson really didn't think he was that special. We don't know. There must have been something about his persona, his demeanor, because obviously he was something incredible.
Well, Lewis and Clark are in a hurry. They've got a lot going on. At the time that they met him, they were enduring a court-martial. A man named John Newman had mouthed off and said things of mutinous purpose, and they had to court-martial him. It was the last important court-martial of the expedition.
And that sort of story and him being beaten on a sandbar, I'm sure, traveled throughout Indian country.
And so that whipping occurred on a sandbar on the North Dakota-South Dakota border, and Tooney was with them, and he cried out and said, "Wait a minute, we don't humiliate a person this way. Are you sure you want to do this?" And then Clark says, "Well, Tooney, here's how we do things, and this is important." And Clark says Tooney understood. I don't think he understood. I think he said, "We don't whip our children ever. That if we," and he goes on to say, "if we really are mad, we kill a guy, but we don't publicly humiliate them ever." And so there's this, like, I love these moments. There are six or seven of them in the expedition, David, where the native peoples are the civilized ones and they regard the white people as the savages. I love when that mirror is turned.
Because it shows difference between cultures and it leads to questions and understanding. There are a couple of different accounts. I'm hoping I can get you to talk about this, where Tooney and Clark are walking the shore and Tooney is sharing information and talking about the different special places. I just think that's fascinating. And boy, you know, you're talking about trying to have a time machine and drop in on a conversation. That's one I'd like to do.
Well, that's what I found so fascinating. So as they're coming up the river after the Arikara and before the Mandan, it's about a 125-mile stretch, Clark famously says in the journals, "Oh, this guy, Arkeeter Narsher, told me a bunch of stuff about medicine places and sacred stuff and this and that and effigies," and he said, "none of which I consider worth recording." And that's been the way people have thought about this, that here was this man, Tooney, telling Clark his culture's traditions, and Clark was like, "Nah, not too interested, nothing urgent there." But what I discovered in looking at the map and then comparing it to what Clark actually did write during that three-week period is that he was listening, that the journals reflect Clark's growing curiosity about what came out of Tooney's mouth, and Clark then talks about the Medicine Rock, which is down near Elgin, North Dakota, and other places that he never would have talked about without Tooney informing him of these things.
The Medicine Rock we need to come back to because you've been there. But on that subject, you know, at the same time, they had something you referred to earlier, the Evans map.
Right. They had John Evans' map, who had come up in the 1790s looking for Welsh Indians.
And they had all of these, there were supposed to be these extraordinary landmarks. And Clark spent, what, two or three days without success trying to find them. So we know Clark was interested, right?
Yeah, I mentioned this in my essay in We Proceeded On, and I invite people to subscribe and to read for themselves. But what I say is, and it's a little bit hard on Lewis and Clark, but I say this Welshman, John Evans, had been up in the 1790s. He left a map and an account. Clark gets off the boat and goes searching for these places, Jupiter's House and a couple of other things. And he never finds them, but he makes it a real quest to affirm what Evans had been pointing at. But he shows less interest in a Native American's view of the same countryside.
Now, do you think that's true?
Yes.
And it was because they were Native.
It was because they were Indians. And so here you have a Native American who knows everything there is to know about this landscape, and he wants to tell the white person.
And he speaks 11 languages, so there's no communication
barrier.
Right,
so they got Joseph Gravelines to translate. So he wants to divulge what he knows, and Clark is like, yada, yada, yada. But then Clark is like, "Oh, this white person was up here. Let's go confirm the things that he arbitrarily names from Greek mythology out here." It's a little bit of the Eurocentrism that, frankly, one would expect. That's how Eurocentrism works. But what I discovered was that even if he says those slightly contemptuous things, he is listening, and a lot of Tooney's data wound up in the journals, and all of it is on the map, and the map deepens the journals, and the journals deepen the map.
I want to get back to Thomas Jefferson, maybe talk a little bit about his instructions to Lewis and some of the maps that were commissioned by Lewis and Clark. But you must share your story of Medicine Rock, please.
Well, long ago when I returned...
I've never been there, so I'm jealous.
I've got to take you there. When I returned to North Dakota, I read about this. I read about it in Clark. I was editing the journals of Lewis and Clark for North Dakota, and I produced a book called A Vast and Open Plain, The Writings of the Lewis and Clark Expedition
in
North
Dakota.
We need
to put a link on the webpage at jeffersonhour.com.
I'm very, very proud of that work.
It's a great piece of work.
Hundreds and hundreds of annotations, and it's really the only edition of Lewis and Clark anywhere that has every journal keeper every day on the day that he wrote. Normally, Lewis and Clark get volume one, and then the other journalists get volumes 9 and 10. I brought it all back together, including the weather data and all the letters they wrote and everything else. So anyway, that was done with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. And while I was doing it, I read about this Medicine Rock. So I thought, well, I'll just go see if it's still there. I drove out there, and it is still there. It's a State Historical Society site near Leith or Elgin, North Dakota, southwestern North Dakota, about 50 miles, I'd say, from Bismarck and about 40 miles from the Missouri River. It's surrounded by a chain link fence, and it was, I'm using a kind of a cross-cultural term here, but it was sort of the Oracle at Delphi. So native peoples of different tribes, it wasn't just Mandan, would go there, and they would fast and do sweat lodge ceremonies and smoking ceremonies and so on. And then they would consult this rock and say, should we go to war against the Cheyenne, or should we move our winter camp to the Killdeer Mountains? And, questions of destiny. And then they would go away and dance and sleep and fast. And then a day or so later, they'd come back, and this rock would reveal to them their destiny. There would be something inscribed on the rock, or there would be a way of looking at the lichens and the patterns, but the rock would deliver wisdom. And so Lewis and Clark write about this. Then Prince Maximilian wrote about it in the 1830s. The Stephen Long expedition up in the late 18-teens wrote about it. So I went. There it is. And I'll tell you what's so amazing about it, David. You know native culture so much better than I do. It's in the middle of the middle of the middle of nowhere, and it's in the heart of a Anglo-European part of North Dakota. It's a long way from Indian country. And yet, every time I go there, I find medicine bundles tied to the fence. These are little pieces of tobacco that are rolled up in a handkerchief and strung on a string, like a bit like a rosary. And native peoples come from apparently all over America, certainly all over the Great Plains, and pray there, and they leave these medicine bundles. And so it's still sacred to native peoples. And most non-native North Dakotans have never heard about it or care, for that matter, but I find it fascinating.
Yeah, there's a photograph.
I went there in the winter. A photograph of it.
Walking through 10 below wind chill. And
it was.
Yeah, but on page 26 of We Proceeded On in the May issue, there is a picture of
it's a great day.
Yeah, it's a great photo. I've got it. I'd like to
see. I'll take you there.
I think it's. I referenced a book that I read. One Vast Winter Count.
Oh, sure. That's
and,
great
you know,
book.
I think there's a, in the beginning of that book, there's a tremendous explanation of how other cultures that populated this area looked at the land and the landmarks. And, you know, that's kind of a great understanding of the difference between the Tuni map and a Western typical map. It's more of a record keeping, and this happened here and this happened here. So,
It's not a calendar in the sense that Thomas Jefferson would understand, but it's a calendar in another sense. And so this is not a map in the usual sense. But, for example, if you got a state highway map of North Dakota today, it wouldn't mark sacred places.
No.
But Tuni marked and drew the sacred sites of the Arikara world.
And just because we, in our side of the culture, don't really look at the land as a sacred thing. I mean, you know, where we live is notorious for that. Anything that's old, you tear it down.
What is sacred?
Yeah.
And how do you determine what's sacred? If I see a Lutheran church on the prairie, I know, well, that's a sacred place to Lutherans.
Right.
If I see a cathedral, as in Richardton, North Dakota, Catholic cathedral, I think, okay, that's a sacred place to Roman Catholics.
So the difference is these sacred places were not built by the hand of man. They were built by someone else's hand.
Because, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it's always a mistake to overgeneralize about Native Americans, but they didn't feel the need to put up an edifice The place itself was sacred. That you don't need to build a shelter around it. Going there, the sacred, the medicine, the walk-on, the sacredness is right there. It's inherent in the place, and you just need to open your eyes and ears. And if you open them in a culturally sensitive and appropriate way, with the proper use of medicine men and prayer and fasting and all the things that you do, if you open your ears, if you open your heart and soul to the place speaks to you. And so white people think, well, that's not how we do it. We go in a church and we sing a hymn and we play a song and we pray. Native Americans have a different way of doing the sacred, and that's why I love this place.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I could add anything to that, except that you and I have had this discussion before in connection with Lewis and Clark and Jefferson, the value of oral tradition, oral history, and you'd say, you know, they need an edifice there. Now, oral history and oral tradition has passed this knowledge down, and the absolute proof of it is that you found medicine bundles at Medicine Run.
As you do at Bear Butte in South Dakota and other places, but this is such an unusual one because if you look at this, even in that photograph that's in We Proceeded On, if you look from a mile away, you would never think, oh, that must be a Native American sacred place. It looks like just another sandstone outcropping on the Great Plains. But when you go up there, you find the medicine bundles and you think, whoa, somebody still is intact in that tradition.
We're coming up on a break, Mr. Jenkinson, but when we return, I'd like to ask you about a couple things. I'd like to talk a little bit more about Jefferson's instructions to Lewis and some of those maps, and also a new painting that you have shared with me that's pretty fantastic.
David, I just have to say I'm loving being the editor of We Proceeded On, and people who have been writing me saying, how can I see this map and how can I read what everyone has written about this, including my friend Kevin O'Brien. The thing to do is to go to the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation, which is headquartered in Great Falls, Montana, and you can subscribe to We Proceeded On, and then you'll read every of the four journal issues per year.
And you'll find a link to their website at jeffersonhour.com. Right now, sir, we are going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. And this week, Clay, I must thank you for indulging me in my enthusiasm about this subject, talking about Lewis and Clark and this map that was recently discovered and published in the May issue of We Proceeded On, of which you are the editor. But I'd like to get back to our man Jefferson just a little bit, if I might.
Of course.
Something that you brought up years ago when we first had conversations about Lewis and Clark, and that is this incredible letter of instruction that Jefferson gave to Meriwether Lewis.
Yes, it was June 20th, 1803, and Jefferson, it was really one of his great moments. He laid out the mission statement for the expedition, and he said many different things, but he basically said, go all the way to the source of the Missouri, cross over whatever the mountains are, go all the way down to the mouth of the Columbia, and come back again. And meanwhile, take notes. Take lots of notes.
Well, two things that stuck out in that letter, you know, which is it's an interesting letter, is he talks about all the equipment that they have received, and so you know, instruments for ascertaining by celestial observations the geography of the country. He wanted maps. He wanted detail. He wanted explanations, and he also gives them really specific instructions for how to deal with the indigenous people.
Right, and among other things, he says, when in doubt, pull back. Don't get yourself into some sort of a battle with native peoples. If they're determined to turn you back or to resist your progress, it would be better for you to come back and we'll regroup and send out a larger party or another time. But don't take the bait in a provocation and have some sort of a bloodbath out there. He said, bend over, conciliate wherever possible, because harmony is the theme of my administration.
Yeah, and reading the letter, I believe him. He meant that. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about was, we mentioned earlier, with Joseph Gravelines, who is somebody I really don't know that much about, but it reading about it, it almost seems like maybe it would have been better for them to dump Toussaint Charbonneau and or hire him additionally.
You are speaking heresy. If they had if they had dumped Charbonneau,
they would have lost the Cuckoo.
We wouldn't know who that woman was. She one of the things I've discovered in my own editing of the journals is that she is not mentioned until they get well into Montana, after she plays a significant role in saving one of the boats when it's tipping over. Up till then, she's just the woman, the Indian woman, the wife of Charbonneau. If Charbonneau's strike had continued, if Lewis and Clark had said, well, the heck with it, we're not hiring you, stay here, and had hired Joseph Gravelines instead, a much better man, we would never have heard about Sacagawea, and we might not be having this conversation, because this came up again and again during the bicentennial, David. What can you take out of this story and still keep the story? You can take out William Werner and Joseph Potts, John Potts, and even George Shannon.
Well, I'm not sure if I even agree with that argument. But
you can take these people out. You take Sacagawea out of this story, there is no story.
You don't know that.
I believe that.
Yeah, okay. Well,
Maybe
they should have just added Gravelines on her. Perhaps
Gravelines was a French-Canadian. He had spent 20 years with the Aricara. He knew their language well. And they counted on meeting these traders amongst the tribes. He served as a translator, and Lewis and Clark really admired him, and they sent him as the chaperone of Tooney when Tooney went off to Washington to meet Jefferson. And Gravelines then had to come back with the sad news that Tooney had died in the District of Columbia.
And then lastly, there's this new painting that you have sent to me that's pretty incredible. Can you tell listeners about it?
Well, going back to the instructions, David, so the instructions are like this Enlightenment mission statement. You want to get their languages, and you want to learn their ethnographies, and you want to learn the geography and bring back soil samples and plants and rare and unusual animals, etc. Jefferson says, like, I want you to observe everything and write down perfect descriptions of it and use all these scientific instruments, the theodolite and the compass and your chronometer and everything, and just bring back data. Data, that's what I want. And so this painting I discovered for the next issue, for the August issue of We Proceeded On, it's by a man named Peter Waddell. He's a New Zealander who is now a naturalized American citizen, and he paints for the White House Historical Association. And he painted an image I found by just Google searching. I'd never heard of him. And the image is of Jefferson sitting in the White House with Meriwether Lewis standing in front of him. And Jefferson has just finished his instructions. The painting is dated June 20th, 1803.
But it's great. It's like one of those puzzles.
It
where
is.
You say, so how many references can you find? Like, I mean, we see Dick, his mockingbird flying.
His mockingbird's flying, geraniums, and maps, and globes, and his glasses.
Just a real fun picture.
And a Greek vase, and books up and down, his five-sided music stand or book stand. And so I actually have created a quiz for the August issue of We Proceeded On.
Really?
And I say, how many of these objects can you identify?
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of the issue, I wrote a long description of each of the objects. And I worked with our friend Pat Bradowski. I sent her the list and the painting, and I said, help me. And she wrote back, and as usual, you know what she said? There's a chair. If you look at the painting, David, there's a Windsor chair, a wooden Windsor chair next to the bookshelf. And I'm saying, tell me what you can about this. She said, well, you know, I just made a Windsor chair. I mean, think of that. She just made one. She actually constructed one. She's like a living embodiment of the Foxfire books. And she made one and told me all about it.
And on the outside chance she's listening,
Pat,
we got flowers. I got your Brad's Atomic Grape Tomato Seeds and gave a seedling to Clay. How's it doing?
It's alive.
Well,
that's
enough.
All I can say.
That's
but
enough.
This painting is utterly fascinating.
It really is.
I interviewed Peter Waddell, and I'll be publishing it in two forms in the August edition of We Proceeded On. And what it is, David, is essentially a map of the Enlightenment.
Yep.
Maps, books,
that's
scientific
great.
Instruments, writing instruments, the kind of artifacts Jefferson collected for the lobby at Monticello. And I should say, before we go, I just got a call, and I get to go to Monticello at the end of September and give two lectures, one for a dinner in the house, and the other one out on the West Lawn, and then both of them are about this subject, Jefferson and the West, and Jefferson and Lewis and Clark.
I feel like we could talk on and on and on about this.
Forever.
We really didn't get into Tooney as much as we could have, but go to jeffersonhour.com. You can find out how to join.
And please do subscribe, because this is an organization that deserves your attention, and I'm trying to make this journal a much more important Lewis and Clark vehicle than it has been.
Well, before we go, I must say, Clay, thank you for a delightful conversation. And to those of you listening, thank you for listening. If you'd like to find out more about the Thomas Jefferson Hour or support the show, go to jeffersonhour.com. You'll find old programs, essays, all sorts of information. And with that, sir, it is now time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
One of the great mysteries of the Lewis and Clark expedition is why Meriwether Lewis did not keep a steady journal. The expedition was on the road for 28 months, much of it through terra incognita, lands never before mapped, named, or written about by European-derived people. Lewis was silent for 441 days, more than half of the time. Fortunately, we have Clark's journal, and those of John Ordway, Patrick Gass, Joseph Whitehouse, and for a time, Charles Floyd. So we do have some written record of every single day of the expedition between 1804 and 1806. Still, nobody wishes Meriwether Lewis had written less, and everyone who has ever studied the expedition wishes that Lewis had somehow managed to write a journal entry for every single day. I have argued in my book, The Character of Meriwether Lewis, Explorer in the Wilderness, that Lewis's silences before, during, and especially after the expedition were what killed him. If he had kept in touch with his patron and mentor Thomas Jefferson, things would have gone better for him. If he had kept in touch with the War Department in James Madison's administration, he probably would not have been rebuked by Secretary of War William Eustace in August of 1809. That rebuke was so severe that it effectively disintegrated Lewis's sense of himself, as well as effectively bankrupted him, and it precipitated his fatal journey from today's Memphis, Tennessee, along the Natchez Trace in October of 1809. Almost everyone agrees that Lewis committed suicide at a squalid hut on the Natchez Trace on October 11th, 1809. If Lewis had written his book, he would have been able to face Jefferson, who had been pressuring him to get it into print, and he would have been able to offer it as proof to his critics in the Madison administration that he had been doing something worthier than corresponding with the War Department during 1808 and 1809. It was the silence that killed him. So if we had Lewis before us today, and he had no reason to withhold information or distort the truth as he knew it, how would he explain his silences in the expedition's journals and his failure of communications as the governor of Upper Louisiana in St. Louis? I've spent a significant part of my life portraying Meriwether Lewis, so I have had the challenging opportunity to try to see the world through his eyes. So I don't just come at this from the outside in, but also, to a certain degree, from the inside out. I think he would say this first. You try doing what I did and see if you keep a daily diary. First, I lead a dangerous reconnaissance mission into the heart of darkness, not knowing from day to day what lies around the next bend in the river, how high and wide the Rocky Mountains are going to be, how I'm going to feed 30-some, 20-somes who eat 5 or 6 or 8 pounds of animal flesh per day, in a seething wilderness without a shop or convenience store between St. Louis and the Pacific Ocean, and it turns out there are none there either. You try holding all of this together. You meet more than 50 Indian tribes, none of whose languages you speak and none of them knowing English, not knowing whether they're going to feed you or kill you in one fell swoop or send out snipers to cut you down one by one on the river. You fend off gazillions of mosquitoes, gnats, flies. You walk 3,000 miles over sharp rocks and prickly pear cactus in inadequate footwear, spend day after day up to your armpits in the river swollen with spring runoff that was mountain snow just 2 weeks ago. You try spending hundreds of hours trying to determine latitude and longitude by looking at the moons of Jupiter through a small telescope no better than a pair of binoculars, 2 or 3 or 4 times in the middle of the night, wind whipping the plains, or at 43 degrees below zero at Fort Mandan. You take the temperature twice a day, dawn and mid-afternoon, for the hyper-disciplined and fastidious Jefferson. You try to take down vocabularies of all the Indian tribes you meet when the translation chain sometimes involves 3 or 4 or 5 individuals, none of them professional linguists, and some of them not much more than buffoons. Filling in Mr. Jefferson's printed grid of 250 words, birth, death, sun, moon, stars, but also mammoth. You go out every day and dig up prairie plants all the way down to their deepest roots. Press them in blotter paper. Describe every detail with scientific precision. Affix labels in an age before Post-its and open those blotters constantly to make sure that the plants are pressing properly and not molding from the rains. You fend off buffalo stampeding through your camp at night and grizzly bears that would just as soon rip open your bowels as give you the right of way. You try butchering your elk or bison in the field and then eating it within an hour of the slaughter when the muscle tissue is still quivering and the butchers are covered with blood head to foot without soap or moist towelettes. You give 30 horny young men a temperance lecture so they don't all get STDs that would debilitate them from the sheer hard work that will be required to get your men, map, and notes back to civilization. You handle all the accumulating testosterone in the middle of nowhere without any of the social and familial support and restraining mechanisms that you could count on in the merest frontier village, the belching, swearing, bickering, chattering, snoring. Some of the men screw-ups, one of them always getting lost, several men with the kind of dark spirits you only meet on a very long adventure. And you try to get the entire crew back to St. Louis from the shores of the Pacific Ocean when you're bankrupt, with all of your remaining trade goods, a rusty fishhook, a few needles, some broken beads contained in two faded handkerchiefs. Whereas you had 16 large bales of trade goods on the outbound journey. And you're asking me, Meriwether Lewis, why I didn't find time every day to keep a dear diary? I think that's what he would say. And he would have a similar tale to tell about the post-expedition silences. Jefferson asking his former aide-de-camp, now a national hero, to go to Richmond to observe the Aaron Burr treason trial, while Lewis should be writing his book, or making him run a bunch of errands like getting a pocket watch fixed in Philadelphia, and then appointing Lewis to a political post as far from the Enlightenment world of Philadelphia as it was possible to be, one to which Lewis was not really well qualified, a miasma of overlapping sovereignties, ethnicities, land claim systems, languages, social hierarchies, intrigues, and, of course, on the far western frontier, a petri dish of rogues and scoundrels, including a lieutenant with a lethal case of subordinate envy, and then ask Lewis to find a way, pay any price, bear any burden, to get the Mandan leader Sheheke home after his visit to the Great Father. You try that against a rigor of hostility and the penny-pinching of Madison's War Department. But meanwhile, to finish your three-volume Enlightenment report on the geography, geology, celestial astronomy, botany, mineralogy, mammalogy, soil science, and anthropology of the expedition. All that in St. Louis, a raw frontier town of 3,000 people, of at least five ethnic and linguistic stocks, 886 miles from the intellectual and printing capital of the United States in Philadelphia, and 4,205 miles from the English-speaking world's printing capital in London. You try it. Did Lewis fail? Yes and no. But no more than yes. He made sure there was a journal entry for every day of the voyage. He got his men out to the Pacific coast and back again safely, with only one death among his party, and that from natural causes. He avoided bloodshed with all but one of the Indian tribes he met, sometimes in spite of appalling provocations. He brought back what we would call an artifact and database so rich in material that we are still analyzing it more than 200 years later. It was Jefferson who lost almost all the 29 Indian vocabularies that Lewis assembled. You try that. And it was Jefferson who refused to authorize a national museum without first having paid off the national debt and amended the Constitution for such an enterprise, so that most, virtually all, of the incredible artifacts that Lewis sent or brought back were subsequently lost, burned, or dispersed. These failures are on Jefferson, not Lewis. And as Stephen Ambrose and every thoughtful Lewis scholar concludes, if Jefferson had just sat Lewis down in the East Room or in an apartment in Philadelphia with an amanuensis, some scientific consultants, and a book production budget, rather than posting him into the sordid cauldron of far western frontier politics, Lewis would almost certainly have written his book. I can scarcely keep up a diary in my climate-controlled house on the upper Missouri with adequate footwear and the best moleskin journals, and I know where my next meals are going to come from. I have never had a visceral encounter with a grizzly bear. We need to cut poor Meriwether Lewis some slack. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.